Melissa in the Morning takes a look ahead to see what's on the horizon. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
From candy to costumes, pumpkins to spooky decor, Americans are dropping big money this year on Halloween. In fact, national data shows 73% of shoppers have been buying items tied to the holiday, which is a record number for our country. And with so many people getting in on the holiday, it's important that on the horizon we talk about the safety around this holiday, from the candy to drivers out on the road late at night to some trends that unfortunately we have seen in our crime here in Connecticut and across the country, including kidnaps and car theft. So we want to talk about this with Connecticut State Police. Sergeant Christine Jeltema is back with us on the show to talk all about this. Good morning, Sergeant. Glad to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing well. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, I love talking to Connecticut State Police each and every year about Halloween. First of all, Sergeant, can we clarify something? Remember years and years ago, there were all these fears about razor blades and candies and candies being laced with things. Was that ever true?
So there, I honestly, I don't know, but we have found that there have been items that have been inside candy, whether it was from the manufacturer, a piece of whatever they're using to make the candy. However, we still want parents to look at the candy, if there's open packaging, if there's anything that looks funny, to not have their child consume it, because we don't know what's in there, and we want everybody to be safe.
So when kids are going door to door, it's not enough to just say, I know my neighbors, they're safe people, Sergeant. Why would I check the candy? You should still go in and check it, even if it's down to just, did a manufacturer mess up the candy? You want parents checking it.
Correct. And now with cannabis and gummies and things like that that are out there on the market, somebody may not know or understand, or packaging sometimes looks the same. So we really want parents to read labels and see what's inside those candies, because unfortunately, we know that some children throughout the country have consumed these types of gummies, and it has been lethal, or they've become really sick and had to be hospitalized. So please, we ask parents and even individuals who are looking to buy candy to check the labels and make sure it's something that is safe for children.
Last year, I remember there was a huge fear, Sergeant, which I'm sure you remember as well, in the rainbow fentanyl that looked like candy. And there were some forms of it that looked like chalk, but again, attracting younger kids to this very deadly drug. Have we heard of anything like that being detected here in Connecticut?
Not that I've been made aware of. Obviously, we know as the Halloween season is coming ahead in a couple of weeks, kids will be out trick-or-treating. I'm sure we'll get some more information nationwide of some trends that we're seeing, and we'll obviously put that stuff out on our website, cspnews.org, or on our Facebook and social media pages.
And again, we have Sergeant Christine Jeltema here, who is with Connecticut State Police. We're talking about Halloween safety. Drivers out at night, obviously you've got kids who are out and about. It's certainly, we always recommend that people wear reflector items, whether it's the parent who's out with their kids, or if you've got teenagers who are going to go out later in the night, definitely wearing reflector gear. But what do you want to tell drivers who might be leaving work late that night, or could just be out for a dinner or an occasion or whatever the case may be? What do you want to tell drivers?
Yes, definitely be on the lookout for anything or anybody that's out, whether they're walking on the roads, if there's sidewalks in the area. We encourage families to use sidewalks, like you said, reflective type costumes, flashlights, whether it's the kids, adults, or all. But for the drivers, to slow down, there are speed limit signs, but not only follow the speed limits, but even just the slower speed. Be mindful, ditch those distractions, see what's going on in the area. Just being mindful will really have somebody be able to focus on what's in front of them, so they can see if there's any children or individuals that are out trick-or-treating and having a good time.
It's
if they're going to... Oh, sorry.
No, no, no.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
So the other thing is, if anybody's going to consume alcohol, either get a ride share, whether it's an Uber, a Lyft, or a taxi, or a designated driver, because we know that individuals who have been consuming alcohol and or drugs might not be able to see anything, or their reaction time might not be enough to stop if there's something that is in the roadway.
Yeah, and that was actually what I was going to kind of comment on is I've heard of these situations where I feel bad for the driver, actually, where kids dart out in the middle of the road. Yeah. And you could be a very safe driver. You may not have anything in your system, but you've got kids who are – look, I've got a five-year-old, and I'd be lying to you. I have talked to my kid – I don't know how many times, probably till I'm blue in the face, Sergeant, about don't ever run out. You got to look both ways, all of that. But if they were to dart out and the parent doesn't catch them quick enough, it's so important that even if you are driving, when you go through those neighborhoods, I would think it's so important that you're almost rolling, where if you, God forbid, hit a child who darts out, it's not going to be lethal because it does happen, unfortunately, where they just dart in the middle of the road. You don't want them to, but they do.
Right, right. Yes. And I agree. Just those slow speeds in those areas, if you know it's a heavy area where people are trick-or-treating and out and about, just please, we ask, it's slow speeds, those distractions, get off the phone. If there's young kids out there and you're having conversations in the car, just be mindful of your surroundings and what is going on out there. As a parent, if your kids are old enough and they are going out by themselves, having those conversations with them as well and being an example will also help keeping everybody safe out there for this Halloween season.
And I'm so glad you mentioned kids going out on their own, Sergeant, because that was going to be my next question. There's been such a heightened, I would say, focus by families across Connecticut and really across the nation about kidnapping, child abductions. Unfortunately, we have seen that happen far too often. I know the New York case that ended well, thank God,
yes,
has been something people are talking about, but that's kind of rare that it would end that way. We have seen kids approached too many times here in Connecticut. What would you say, what should parents be talking about with their kids, and how should kids be prepared when they go out, especially at night, even if they're with friends? What should they be doing to make sure that they are staying safe from stranger danger or anything like that?
So, yes, the buddy system. Always have a friend with you. If you have a child that is coming home and that other child, their buddy, has to go back home and they're by themselves, maybe as the parent, go with them, drive them home, something. But the buddy system always works. And having a cell phone or something where you can make a phone call 911 if there's something that looks strange, or if you find yourself in a situation as a teenager or a young child in a situation where you fear that something may happen, calling 911 is always the best thing. And again, those conversations with parents, for parents to their children, I know some of these cell phones have GPS locators on them, or there's other things out there. I know those iTag or Apple Tag, excuse me, that our parents could use could help locate somebody. So having those location finders or something that has the ability your child not get in these situations or be able to find them immediately in the event that they don't come home on time, and setting those parameters for curfews is huge as well.
We're getting ready for the Halloween holiday coming up in just a couple of weeks, and joining us is Connecticut State Police Sergeant Christine Jeltema. Now, Christine, you had just mentioned the buddy system. It's a no-brainer for kids going out without parents with them. Does that include high school-aged students?
Yes, definitely high school age students. And I would highly encourage the buddy system when it comes to those high school age students, especially if they're going to be driving. So that way you can help the driver and be another eyes in the car out and about in those heavily traffic areas where kids will be trick-or-treating.
We saw a situation earlier this month where I believe she was 11 years old. A girl was leaving her house, and it was the middle of the day, and a guy approached her and tried pursuing her, and she ran into a Dunkin' Donuts, a Dunkin', and they were able to call 911 and arrest the guy. How important would you say it is, Sergeant, that when kids are going out, if they're going out alone, even if you're in a group, that you find, you know, know, local businesses or point of contact, or that they know they can go up to the house where they're trick-or-treating, for example, and say, hey, I need to use your phone. I think I'm being approached by someone. I would think that that is a conversation you should also be having with your kids.
Absolutely. Conversations are keys with your children. Letting them know what to do in these types of situations, what these situations may look like, how to react to them, and where to go, and finding a trusted adult, especially if it's a business or if it's a house in the area. And I know some people may be kind of weary if somebody's knocking on their door asking to use a phone, but listen, you can hear the tone of inflection of a voice of somebody who is scared. So use that and take care of these young kids out there, and to make sure that they stay safe and that we can find individuals that are trying to do these types of situations in these situations.
And whether you're a homeowner that's going to be participating in handing out candy or not, how important is it, Sergeant, that people are locking their cars and their driveways and that they're making sure that their valuables are not just out there in plain sight, as Connecticut has continued to see a real issue with car theft and car break-ins?
Yes, having your vehicles locked, taking all the valuables that are out there, anything that may be visible that may encourage somebody to get into these vehicles, take them out, put them in a safe place in your house. If you're going to be participating in having individuals, kids, families coming to the house to get candy, have one small area where you can open up the door or stay outside to hand out candy so individuals may not see what is inside your house to see if there's anything that may be of value. So when they know you're not home or there's an opportunity for them to break into your house, they can't see any types of items that may be in there that might be worth them stealing.
That's such a good point, Sergeant. I didn't even think about the fact that this could be a great opportunity for people posing as trick-or-treaters can actually really be scoping out where's my next target if I want to go and steal stuff or break into a home. I didn't even think about that.
Yes. Yeah, and, you know, we also ask that if families are out trick-or-treating to be mindful of homes that might have their lights on or lights off. If there's homes that don't have lights on, not to approach those homes either, because maybe they don't want to participate. I know we're talking about locking up valuables and vehicles and seeing things in their house, but I just want to reiterate, too, that having lights on in a certain area where you want these people to go may help them from walking in front of your yard or your windows in your front yard to get to the front door. So shutting those lights off in those bedrooms may not allow individuals to see inside as well.
That's a really great point. And Sergeant Christine Jeltema, is there anything else that State Police is worried about ahead of Halloween or wants to make sure people are thinking about before they go out and celebrate?
No, just to reiterate the main things that we ask the public to do to make sure that everybody's safe is, again, reflective costumes, flashlights. If you're going to be driving a vehicle, slow down, ditch those distractions, and be mindful of your surroundings when you're in those areas. If you're going to consume alcohol, utilize a rideshare program, a designated driver, or just stay where you're going to be, because we want everybody to have fun and be safe.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, Sergeant Christine Jeltema, I want to thank you so much for giving us this information ahead of Halloween, and good luck to Connecticut State Police. Hopefully it's not too busy of a night for troopers, and I know we'll talk to you again really soon.
Very good. Thank you for having us.
Of course. Thank you again. Sergeant Christine Jeltema here with the Connecticut State Police on WICC. Don't you dare shoot the messenger, okay? I'm not putting winter vibes out there or anything. I'm just trying to do my job, make sure I could save you some money, hopefully. Get your homes prepped before it gets too cold out there and the winter season is upon us. Listen, it's New England. Who knows when we're going to get our first snowfall, if in fact we'll get one. But we do know it will get cold because that's where we live in this country. It gets cold here come late November, early December. So I want to make sure that you are prepped. And on the horizon, before you know it, it's going to be the colder months. So we have Eversource here. The energy efficiency expert at Eversource, Ricardo Jordan, is here to share with us some tips, tricks, what we should be doing now to start preparing our homes, kind of weatherizing them so we're ready for the winter months ahead. Ricardo, welcome to WICC. How are you?
I'm doing well, Melissa. How are you this morning?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. Can you first start off by telling me, Ricardo, how I would say, how often or how like common is it for Connecticut residents to sort of miss the boat on this, whether that is to make sure that they have cracks sealed or pipes are taken care of or whatever the case may be? How common is it for Connecticut residents to miss the mark on getting their homes ready for the winter and then finding themselves in some trouble, unfortunately?
Well, I mean, I think it's very common for homeowners. I mean, we're so focused on everything else we're doing. Many times we forget about those little things going on inside our homes that have a huge impact, especially during the winter season. It's not uncommon.
Yeah, I would think. I mean, I would think so. I've lived here almost my whole life. I've lived in New England my entire life. And I just find that pipes bursting or, you know, losing heat from cracks in your, you know, whatever. It's just a very common thing. And then you end up sort of being with everyone else who also didn't prep ahead of time. And there's a backup for service or it's going to cost you a lot more or whatever the case may be. So that's why we wanted to have you on now so that people can start prepping before it gets too cold out there. What would you say are the most common issues that could go wrong with a home in the wintertime?
Well, Melissa, I think you nailed it with leaks. So in terms of weatherizing the home, one of the first things you want to do is you want to look at things like doors and windows. It's one thing to not let the cold air come in, but you don't want the hot air to escape. So take a look at windows, take a look at doors, see if you feel any cold draft. And if you do, you can use simple things like caulking or weather stripping to make that seal really tight and create a nice barrier. One of the other things that we also recommend, though, when it comes to doors and windows, is use the locks, use the latches. That just applies an extra seal. I know I do it myself, and it makes a tremendous difference with windows and doors. Tremendous difference.
That's so interesting. So actually, so just shutting your windows, for example, like I know I'm guilty of this. You're saying actually latch them locked, like use the latches, and that actually will seal them in tighter than if you were to just shut the window.
Yeah, it provides a nice extra seal.
All right. So
start cold air out.
Start getting into that habit now of doing that with your windows so that by the time we get to the winter months, you're already in the habit of doing it. Now,
absolutely.
What about reversing the fan direction? I've heard that it can do wonders during the winter and even in the summer months. What's the deal with that?
Yeah. So when it comes to ceiling fans, the thing with ceiling fans is they're really designed to cool the person. They're not designed to really cool or heat the space. So when you have them running in the counterclockwise direction, it's going to push all that heated air down, and that's where you want it. You don't want the air to get lost into the ceiling or in other spaces where it's not needed. It's just going to make your heating system work even harder. So turn your ceiling fans running counterclockwise. Keep the air where you want it to be. It makes a huge difference.
So again, we're talking to Ricardo Jordan, who is the energy efficiency expert at Eversource. We want to make sure your homes are prepped for the winter season. I know we're just starting to enjoy the fall. I know we just started to get out of the heat, actually, and fall feels like it just got here. So why are we jumping ahead?
It snuck up.
Right? Yeah, it did. And I'm sure there are people listening, and they're like, oh, Melissa, please, not now. But the reason that we're doing this is because when you get into the winter season, I don't want you to run into a problem and then be on a long waiting list to have people like Eversource come out to fix up your homes or things like that. We want to make sure that they are in good shape right now. What about pipes, Ricardo? That's probably a huge problem that anyone who experiences a deep freeze, which we had a few of those events last year, unfortunately has seen a pipe burst before. What are things that either we could be doing to make sure they're in good shape or tactics that we should be thinking about when the first deep freeze sort of sneaks up on us? Because that tends to happen.
Yeah, so I would take a look at any piping you have with water running inside the home. If it's not insulated, I would insulate it right away because you don't want those pipes to be exposed, because when they get that cold exposure, I mean, they can freeze up, and that can cause a lot of problems inside the home with your water system, especially with the heating system if you use water. So definitely insulate those pipes when you can. Every now and then, I would actually try to run the water of your home a little bit every now and then, and make sure that you've got some good flow, because you obviously want to prevent any freezing of the pipes, because that can be a huge problem for a homeowner.
What is one of the biggest concerns people have in the wintertime, of course, is that they are cranking the heat, right? And then, unfortunately, their bills skyrocket because we had a very, very warm summer and even a warm part of fall. So we really haven't had to touch the heat at all. But we know it's inevitable and people are going to crank the heat. What degree is acceptable? And are there ways to kind of get around cranking the heat? Are there ways to keep either your home warm or yourself warm inside without getting into those higher digits and now having to pay a much heftier bill?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, I like to be comfortable, especially during the winter. I think everyone's a little different, but I think I'll say this. If you have a programmable thermostat or a smart thermostat, you're off to a great start. I'd recommend getting one if you don't. But when you're home or when you're awake, you definitely want to be comfortable. I would set it as low as you can and stay comfortable. But when you're asleep or when you're not home, see what you can do to turn that thermostat down. We found that for every degree that you lower your thermostat, you actually save about 2% on your heating bill. So when you go off those numbers, it can make a huge difference, especially when you're not home.
Well, and a lot of us, Ricardo, aren't home during the day or even, like you said, at nighttime. I mean, there's no shame in having the 4 or 5 blankets. I know we sleep with a lot of blankets, which I'm sure my husband would love for me to eliminate some layers. But
my wife as well.
Yeah.
My wife as well.
Listen, once we start having kids, we get colder. I swear that's the science behind it. But it really you don't need to crank the heat like at bedtime. That's a really great point. Same thing with your kids. And then when you're not in the home, I mean, my gosh, so many people are working 8 hours a day. And it's like, what are you doing with all that heat? That's a really good point. Now, what degree can you bring it down to that it doesn't put your pipes at risk or anything like that? Like, what is an acceptable level to bring it down to?
Well, I think around 68 degrees is a good temperature, especially when you're home. And if you can lower that, again, while you're asleep, I think you put yourself in good shape. But again, we want residents to be as comfortable as they can be. Just know, every degree you lower that temperature thermostat, you save about 2% in your heating. That's big.
That's a big deal for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Ricardo Jordan, I think this is really great information. And again, people just getting prepped. I know that we just started to get into those fall temperatures, but before you know it, winter will be upon us and we want to make sure our homes are set. I know that Eversource, for example, has a program where they can bring an inspector in and for a pretty cheap price to come in and really check your home. Is that all on the website? And if so, what is your website?
Well, I would encourage folks to visit our energy efficiency page, actually, at Eversource.com. And at Eversource.com, you can learn about the many of our energy-saving programs which are available to our customers.
All right. Well, Ricardo, I want to thank you so much again for all of this great information. And hopefully the winter holds off for a while. But whenever it's here, we'll be better prepared. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. I really appreciate it.
All right. Ricardo Jordan, again, who is the energy efficiency expert at Eversource here on WICC's.
Melissa in the Morning takes a look ahead to see what's on the horizon. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
We welcome back to the show Commissioner Brian Hurlburt for the Department of Agriculture here in Connecticut. Hey, Brian, how are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing great. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. I wanted to know how our crop season is looking here in Connecticut. Some of the seasonal favorites that people love, like our pumpkins or our squash, for example. How are we doing with that?
Well, the good news is that there's a crop out there. The bad news, as you alluded to before the break here, is that it's been raining pretty regularly. In fact, we've had rain on 14 of the last 19 weekends. And so what that means is that these farmers spent, their entire season preparing these crops for everybody, harvest them, got them out ready to, ready to showcase, ready to buy. And the rain is keeping people away. They're just not thinking about fall decor or pumpkin carving when it's just dreary and rainy every weekend. So the good news is there are pumpkins, there are apples, the corn mazes are up, the decor is ready to go. We just need people to remember to stop by the farm stand on their way home from work or to work or soccer practice or whatever you might have and to purchase it.
That's so true, because the farm feels, especially with kids, really is enjoyed typically during the weekends, and it just hasn't really been ideal for people to be outdoors and wandering the farms. But as far as the actual health of the crop, it sounds like pumpkins aren't having issues, you know, staying in good shape long. It sounds like there are seasonal squash. There's all kinds of. I mean, that all seems like it's okay. It's just a matter of people showing up to buy it.
That's right. They're there. They're great quality. I had a farmer tell me he's had this is one of his best pumpkin years ever.
Really?
And he raised his eyebrows and he kind of shrugged his shoulders. He's like, for all the rain we got, for all the challenges, we've had a great season. He goes, but now I just need somebody to come by and start buying them. And as we're running out of weekends before Halloween, that just becomes an inventory problem. So it's that's why I'm reminding everybody that the pumpkins are out there. When you go out there, you can buy your apple pie, you can buy some apples, apple cider donuts if that's the draw to get you out to the farm. But the crop is there, and it's looked pretty good for a lot of farms. And so people shouldn't be worried that if they go to the farm stand, there's not going to be a crop there for them. There will be something there. And it'll look pretty good, and it'll look great on your front porch.
Forgive me, Brian, but how did we do with the berry season, though, over the summertime? Didn't we have issues with that because of the weather, or no, not this summer?
So if people remember, this seems like a long time ago, but in February we had a really cold freeze, negative temperatures around the state in different pockets. And then in May we had another freeze, I think it was the May 18th, so very late in the season. So some berry crops were very light, and I'll say it was very sporadic. I know of farms that didn't do any pick your own this year because there wasn't a crop out there for people to come in and pick. And I know of farms that had a pretty good season, not a gangbuster, but they had a pretty good crop out there. People were able to come pick it. So it was just very sporadic and based on the pocket and the immediate weather and the climate that the field was in. Some farms lost apples, apple blossoms in one part of the farm and had a great crop in the other part of the farm, right? Hmm. Same farm, contiguous land. It's all about the elevation, the terrain. So one of the things that, we want to remind people to do is, check out the social media. Give them a call and say, hey, what hours are you open? Is there, if you want to say for, pick your own apples, go to a local orchard, just ask, what hours are you open? Or is it on their Facebook page or their social media? Because they may have different hours this year. And nobody wants to pack up the kids, drive out to the orchard, and then find out that they're not open that particular afternoon. That is not a good family experience. Mm-hmm. So, the 5 minutes to do that work in advance means you can make sure that you have a great experience with your kids. The farm maintains that experience and that expectation of, providing a high-quality opportunity for the family, and we'll drive you back next year.
I know that this costs a lot of money, Brian, to make sure buses are available, but because we're seeing this issue where weekends are getting washed out, I'm wondering if the state is looking at, and maybe they're already doing it, doing a better job of partnering with schools to make sure that kids are getting out to the farms for school trips or after school programs or something to that effect, because weekdays have been fine.
You're absolutely right, and I want to clarify that the Department of Agriculture and Connecticut Grown did not sponsor this, but that's a great question, Melissa, and I'm glad you asked it, because we just launched last Friday our Connecticut Grown for Connecticut Kids grant application, and that is to connect students with local farmers. It is for farmers to sell into schools, so it's in the cafeterias, on the lunch menus, on the breakfast menus, but it's also for farmers to go into the schools and talk about what they do on their farm and engage the children across the state about why agriculture is important. But importantly, it's for the students to get to the farm and see what's going on the farm and see where their food comes from and get a better understanding of, it takes 5 to 7 years before an apple tree is going to produce a crop. You know, pumpkins are planted in the spring and they're not harvested until the fall. And the time and energy and the work that goes into producing these great crops. You know, we think you mentioned Christmas trees a little bit earlier. You know, it takes 7 years before a Christmas tree is ready to harvest. So think about all the time that the farmer is paying attention to that tree and that crop to make sure that when we go there on a weekend in early December, that it's looking beautiful and it's going to look beautiful in our house. So the Connecticut Grown for Connecticut Kids grant program is open. And that's for our farm to school programming. And importantly, this is, you know, we talked a lot about the rain this year. we have a new component for the Connecticut Grown for Connecticut Kids grant program this year, and it's our storage farm program, our storage container farm. So if you think about the storage containers that are on ships moving product across the seas, mm-hmm. there's a company, there's actually a few companies, that retrofit those storage containers to hydroponic growing operations, and they can grow about 8,000 plants, lettuces, greens, you know, smaller plants, not a, you know, not a cucumber or a pumpkin or anything like that, but greens, herbs, lettuces, 5 gallons of water per week. You plug it in, and, you know, that's part of how we're helping Connecticut farmers think through these climate change events, the erratic weather. But then also this program, you have to have a component to sell into a school or bring the students to the container farm so they can learn about this new technology and how we're going to grow things in Connecticut in the future to make sure that we have a food supply.
We've got the commissioner for the Department of Agriculture here in Connecticut, Brian Hurlburt, joining us. And we were just talking about ways to help our farmers here in Connecticut. I wanted to touch on, Brian, the Farmland Restoration Flood Response Grant that mm-hmm. was just announced recently. That's different than the grants you were talking about connecting farmers to school districts in Connecticut, correct?
Correct. Correct. This was, as many of your listeners will remember, you know, the pretty significant flooding that happened in the northwest corner and along the Connecticut River back in July. A lot of rain, flood zones were overwhelmed, and we were trying to think of ways to use the programs that we had available to help farmers do reconstruction, invest in their farms to better withstand the challenges that too much water or sometimes not enough water presents. And the governor was very clear. He said, you know, how can we help people withstand this so we don't deal with this for, you know, the next 5 years, the next 10 years? So we repurposed our farmland restoration grant program and did a specific special allocation for flood response. And we had a number of applications. These were $20,000 investments into different farms across the state. And we had 21 farms apply and receive an award for either repair and replacement of their land or equipment, soil amendments to make sure that the soil could better handle the amount of water, drain more quickly, or hold water depending on whether or not we need, you know, water in the soil like last year when we had a drought. Or site reconstruction. I mean, the amount of the volume and the intensity of the water that came through washed out roads, bridges, stream banks, and things like that. We did a special allocation to invest in these farms so they could do the repair work. Importantly, we talk about on the show a lot together, Melissa, you know, how many jobs that Connecticut farmers provide across mm-hmm. state. By investing in farms, we're making sure that they have some money to keep their employees on to do this work and get them prepared for the next weather challenge. So we just announced that we'll be doing another round in the very near future for other climate resiliency projects. But it's important that, you know, the state has the ability to respond to these things and make smart investments so that we're not just constantly playing whack-a-mole with the challenges that pop up, that we're helping people prepare for the future, recognizing that it takes money and an investment to do that. Mm-hmm. And we want to help farmers with that investment through this process.
And again, can people just go online if they want to get involved with either of these grant programs?
They should go to our ConnecticutGrown.org site. We have some grant tools on there. We're actually redoing our grant program decision tree because we've actually been very fortunate in the department that between the legislature and the governor's budgets, we have more tools than we've had previously. So we want to help farmers walk through what's the right tool for them for the project that they're pursuing, whether it be a new market, whether it be a transition as to what their farm does, or an investment in their land. So that's the easiest way for farmers to manage that. The other thing is, you know, not everybody loves spending time on the web. 860-713-2501. That's the phone number into our office. We'll get you the right person to talk about what you're trying to accomplish.
All right. And one more question, Brian, before you go. I know we are focused on Halloween, but do we have a sneak peek into how we're doing for Christmas trees here in Connecticut?
So if you asked me this back in May, I would have had a very depressing report out that it wasn't looking great. But we're not in May. We're in October, and things change. The freeze in May, that frost that we mentioned a little bit earlier, did stunt a lot of Connecticut Christmas trees. But the weather actually from May through now actually recovered quite well for the Christmas trees. So the trees are looking a lot better than expected. There wasn't nearly the losses that people were expecting. They have, you know, they have caught up whatever they lost back in May. So again, you know, check out the Connecticut Christmas Tree Association or ConnecticutGrown.org. Find a local farm near you. You know, a lot of these Christmas tree farms are really small mom and pop operations, and they really depend on Connecticut residents and actually, you know, our friends and neighbors from Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and New York coming down to spend the day at the farm and pick their tree. You know, like I said earlier, it takes 7 years to grow a tree. So a lot of time, energy, and heartache went into that tree for your holiday celebration. So think about that and appreciate that when you're going out to pick that perfect tree for your family.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And Brian, thank you so much. And one more time, if you don't mind, with the website, if people want to also find farms near them or across the state and what they specialize in, I know we have over 5,000 here in our state. Where can people go?
ctgrown.org, and there's the Connecticut farm map on there. Click on that. You can search by area and find a farm either near you that you want to visit or make a day trip out of it and go across the state and find a farm to spend the day in a different part of the state. You know, the governor, as you mentioned, just released our new Connecticut marketing campaign, Live, Work, Play. You can live in Connecticut, you can work in Connecticut, and you can play at one of our Connecticut farms.
I love that. And again, I want to thank you, Brian, for the work that you do and for always making the time to come on the show. I really appreciate it, and I know we'll have you back really soon.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Melissa. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Brian Hurlburt again, who is the commissioner for the Department of Agriculture right here on WICC. We are just weeks away from the general election here in Connecticut on November 7th, and we want to make sure you're ready to vote. So who better to speak with than our Secretary of State? Stephanie Thomas is back on the show with us. Hey, Stephanie, how are you?
I am well. So great to be back here, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Yes, I'm glad to have you here. Thanks for getting up early and chatting with us. It's so important that we get some voter turnout numbers that Connecticut can be proud of. And we really have elections where people are getting involved. So I want to make sure everyone has the details and that they are set to go before November 7th. Let's talk about being registered to vote. How do you make sure you are registered? And if you're not, what do you do?
Okay, great. Definitely, there's three things I want people to check or do before, like, do it today, right now. Check that you're registered. Many people think they are, but they're not. So you can do that at myvote.ct.gov / register, or just go to myvote.ct.gov, and you'll see the option to check your registration. But also check your polling location. It may have changed if you're not a regular voter. So the last time you voted, it may have been somewhere else. So make sure you do that. And the third thing that people don't think about until election day, make your plan now. Decide if you're able to go in person based on your work schedule, personal schedule, or if you need to vote by absentee. That way you're not rushed and trying to figure it all out at the last minute.
So I think those are some really good things. And how long do people have to make sure they're registered? I think the state makes it pretty flexible, like literally up until the day before. How long do people have to register to vote?
Exactly. You can register up until the day before the election. And here in Connecticut, for general elections, we have same-day registration. But please, please, please don't wait until election day. You can vote. You can register online. Again, go to myvote.ct.gov. You can also go to your local registrar if you want to register. I say don't wait because what happens on election day, people get confused. They go to their polling location thinking they can register, and you can register on election day, but not at your polling location. It's usually at your town hall. So you'd have to call in advance just to find out where the location is in your town, and then you can register that day if you need to.
So again, we have the Secretary of State here, Stephanie Thomas, to make sure you are ready for Election Day, which is coming up in just a few short weeks. Tell us, if you want to get an absentee ballot, Stephanie, what do people have to do to receive that? And also, what are the rules about then putting your absentee ballot into the drop box?
Sure. So stick with me, folks. The easiest thing you can do, absentee ballots are available now. So if you have the option to go to your town hall, visit your town clerk's office, you can go fill out your application, receive your ballot right then and there, vote it, and return it to the town clerk, like one-stop shopping. That is the easiest thing to do. If that's not possible, you have a few options. Absentee ballots in Connecticut are a two-step process. You have to apply. Once the town clerk receives your application, they verify that you're an eligible voter, and then they mail you a ballot, you vote it, and you return it. So you can apply online, same thing, myvote.ct.gov. You can also apply in person at your town clerk's office, even if you can't wait and vote at that moment. You can also get an application at your registrar's office. So once you receive your actual ballot, please, please, please be sure to follow all of the instructions. If you don't sign it, if you do something, I've heard people say, like, oh, I'm going to save a stamp and put two ballots in the same envelope. That is not allowed. So follow the instructions very closely to make sure your ballot will be counted, and then you can mail it in or you can drop it off in the drop box.
And who's allowed to drop it off if you have elderly people who cannot drive or are not able to leave their homes? Who is allowed to drop off your ballot?
So it's a bit complicated of an answer, which is why I'm so in favor of voter education. If you are mailing it or putting it in a drop box, the only people allowed to do that for you, in addition to yourself, has the immediate family member of a student, a designee of a voter who has a physical disability or illness, and they have to be a designee, like a caregiver. Or, you know, it could be a member of your family who's a caregiver. But the main thing is that person has to have consented to be your designee if it's a caregiver. Also, a police officer, a registrar, an assistant registrar, deputy registrar, etc. If you are returning it in person to the town clerk, it can be the immediate family member of a voter. And that's a really important distinction because I think people just think like, hey, you know, my sibling is going to put it in the drop box. I'll give it to them. But that is not the case. They can do that in person with the town clerk, but not at a drop box or returning by mail.
I saw this week, Secretary of State Thomas, that the State Elections Enforcement Commission voted unanimously to investigate elderly housing complexes in several locations across the state, including Norwalk. Obviously, we have what's playing out as alleged absentee ballot fraud in Bridgeport. Tell us what your concerns might be with the absentee ballot drop boxes ahead of this general election. And what is the state doing to make sure that we're not abusing them?
Yeah, so Dropboxes obviously do a lot of good. They're very helpful for many different types of people. And I think we don't have a widespread problem. I feel confident overall about our election security. Prior to when I took office, when the Dropboxes were first put in, the Secretary's office definitely followed the guidance of the Department of Homeland Security that oversees elections, CISA, and they recommended that Dropboxes be placed in very public areas near town halls, police stations. In many towns followed that guidance and have the Dropboxes under surveillance, like we saw in Bridgeport. I think I definitely look forward to working with the legislature next year when they're in session, because I do think surveillance should be required. But more importantly, it should be required that people watch that footage. I think a lot of towns have the cameras, but no one's really monitoring it. And I think that would be a great way to increase the security.
We have the Secretary of State here, Stephanie Thomas, and we're getting ready for the general election coming up in just a few weeks on November 7th. I have an idea. So the Secretary of State and I have talked about this, actually. It's so frustrating that every year it seems like, unless it's a presidential election, voter turnout is just really low in Connecticut. And I don't know if I'm on the money with this, Stephanie, so please feel free to say, oh, that's really sweet that you came up with that idea, but you're totally missing the mark. It's fine. You would know. You're the professional, not me. But I live in Milford. I've spoken to so many people, including people who are in my own family who live in Milford, and they have no idea who's running for the mayor. They have no idea. Mm-hmm. No clue. They have no idea who's running for mayor. They have no idea why we even vote for a clerk. They don't. And what's amazing is not my family, but I have spoken to people in Milford who still think Ben Blake is running the city. Ben Blake has been gone for 5 months. I mean, I'm so serious, Stephanie. And you laugh, and I've laughed too, but it's so true that
I laugh to keep from crying.
Right. It's because it's so, but I do think that we, and I don't know if it's the state or if it's just the municipality, but I don't know if we do a good enough job of letting people know, first of all, the weight of these jobs, the importance of them, and what they actually mean to these people every day. But also, I don't think we do a great job in letting people know about the candidates. And what I mean by that is we've got signs all over Milford. Some of them just say, "We love Carrie." I don't know who Carrie is. Apparently, Carrie's running for mayor. I mean, we've got another one that says Tony G. All you see is Tony G. Who's Tony G? Apparently, he's running for mayor. So what I'm getting at is I'm wondering if the state, because we're going all digital, it seems like the governor's very big into all digital. What do you think about creating a platform where, and municipalities would have to get on board with this, where you go on this website, it could be on the state's website, but you can look up your municipality and you're able to click on. So let's say you go on to Milford's, and when you see Milford there, it says mayoral race. You click on it. It shows the two candidates running, and you click and it goes right to their campaign website so that you know who the person is. You learn about their platforms. You at least can educate yourselves a little bit better, because I know voter turnout, I want to say part of it is because people have no idea what or who they're even voting for, so why bother showing up? Like, that's a mentality of I know people personally who are like, I don't think I'm going to show up. Like, what's the point? I have no idea who I'm even voting for. And it keeps from people just voting down the Democratic line and down the Republican line, like really educating voters incentivizing them to want to vote during the general election. What do you think about that?
Well, Melissa, I hope you come testify in Hartford one day. There's an easy answer for all of this. Funding into our elections. Most people don't realize the Secretary of the State's office has no budget allocated to public outreach and public education.
That's outrageous.
$0.
That's crazy.
So we basically rely on campaigns and parties to tell the public everything there is to know about voting, how to vote. We beg shows like yours to come on to talk about it. And that makes no sense to me. And I think that is part of the reason, like in presidential years, we see about 80% turnout. In local years, it's closer to 33%.
That's insane.
So these are people who are registered, believe in voting, but don't show up. But I think it's because they don't have information. Some people don't even know the election's coming. Some people, as you say, have no idea who's on the ballot, what's on the ballot, why it's important. If I had money, I'd be running ads. I'd be doing mailers, et cetera. But every issue that I talk to people about, things like property taxes, how much open space their town has, how Board of Education dollars are being spent,
yes,
zoning, housing, parking, these are all the things determined in these local years, and only 33%. In some towns, it's as low as 6% are showing up to vote.
That's
and
crazy.
I think Connecticut wants to do better and can do better. We have to get more money into our elections. And by the way, there is a law on the books that enables our office to put together a voter guide, but it's within available appropriations. And apparently there are no available appropriations, so we don't do it.
Yeah, that actually explains a lot, because to me, I really do feel, you know, it's something that I know we try to do on our station. I know a lot of local stations try to do it, where they will let you know about the election night turnout and how numbers are going. But and even letting you know about some of the, you know, the people who are campaigning. We'll have them on the show and stuff. But if you didn't catch it that day, or you don't go back and listen to the podcast, I just think the general population really has no desire to vote, because they just feel like my vote doesn't matter, because I literally have no idea who I'm voting for. I don't know why it even matters. And I don't know if that's even something that municipalities have to come up with that kind of money to figure out, you know, maybe doing open houses. I have to say kudos to Milford a couple weeks ago for doing an open house at City Hall and saying, here's what a city clerk does. Here's what this office does. I don't know how many people showed up, but I just think the education aspect is not there. It's just not there.
In groups like the League of Women Voters, they do a great job. Many towns like mine, they do put together a voter guide. But budgets being what they are for everybody, they usually have it online these days, whereas, you know, a decade or so ago, they might have been able to do a mailer. So funding in the election space, whether it's at the municipal level, the state level, definitely very important. When I was running for office and outdoor knocking, the number one question I would get from people, like just everybody across all parties, was, is there one place I can go and get all the information I need,
exactly,
about who's running and what that job is? And I had to tell them no, because there wasn't.
Let me know when you want me to testify. I just think that if we really want to care about our local politics, we want turnout to be there, people have to feel like they know what they're talking about. And honestly, I'm hearing from people just as a news reporter, they don't know. They just don't know. They don't even realize that someone like Ben Blake hasn't been in office for 5 months. I'm so serious about it, and it's so disheartening, but it's true. So, yeah, you let me know when you want me to testify, because I can't believe
we
don't invest in this. That's crazy.
I agree.
Well, Secretary of State Stephanie Thomas, I really appreciate you coming on ahead of the general election. Thank you so much. We'll continue to try to get the word out there before November 7th. And you're always welcome to come back on the show. Let me know if you want to come back on before the general election on November 7th.
Thanks, Melissa. Always a pleasure. Always happy to come back.
All right. Thank you again. Secretary of State Stephanie Thomas here on WICC. Despite the controversy surrounding them, red light cameras got the green light right here in Connecticut. So what do you need to know as municipalities discuss over the next couple of months whether or not to bring them to their towns and cities and where exactly to put them? We're talking to Connecticut's Department of Transportation about that. Josh Morgan joins us now. Hey, Josh, how are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Long time no talk. Thanks for having me back.
I'm glad to have you here, Josh. First of all, recap for people who might have missed the news, but what are the red light cameras?
Yeah, the red light cameras are speed safety cameras. They're safety devices called automatic traffic enforcement. So a bill passed by the legislature and signed by the governor this year allows municipalities to opt in. They are not being forced to do this program, but it's their choice, and they can choose to install these automated traffic enforcement devices in their communities.
You know, one of the points of controversy, probably the biggest one, is that people think it's an invasion of privacy. What do you think about that, Josh?
Yeah, the legislation is written and crafted in such a way to hopefully allay some of those concerns. So the devices will take a picture of just the license plate, not the vehicle operator, not the surrounding properties or businesses. So it is very limited in terms of just capturing the license plate data, and any of those images are retained within the database, and they're not shared with local or state law enforcement or any other outside agencies. So it's a closed system, which is designed to hopefully stop people from behaving irresponsibly, speeding through communities and running red lights.
That was going to be my question, which is, what is the point of them? But have we seen in Connecticut a lot of issues with people speeding and just going through red lights as of recent history?
I mean, you can probably answer that one too, Melissa, right? I mean, you go around the state, you see how people are driving. I think anyone that's been on the road has sort of had that catch their breath moment because someone has blown through a red light or someone has came flying by them, speeding and driving aggressively. It's a problem in Connecticut. People are driving way too fast. They are ignoring the rules of the road. And, you know, we're confident that these devices used in a limited scope can really help improve safety around Connecticut.
Yeah, both state police and AAA have come on this show so many times saying that our driving habits, especially since the pandemic, they're pretty awful across the board. And I know there are calls about whether or not to have people retested. What more can we do to make our roads safer? So this was just one of the tools in the tool bag, these red light cameras. Now, Josh, where can the cameras go? When you hear red light cameras, are we saying they're literally going into traffic lights? I've heard they could go on signs as well. Where are these cameras being placed?
Yeah, so that's still to be determined. So, you know, just relax any concerns that maybe your listeners have. These are not going to be at every intersection, at every red light in every town and city in Connecticut. The focus here and the way the legislation is written and written deliberately is to avoid abuse of these cameras, avoid missteps that other states have had when they rolled out automated traffic enforcement, which have proven to disproportionately impact people with low incomes, people of color. So this is going to be a data-driven location, and that's where the state is going to step in to help communities. So when they identify areas, we can provide crash statistics, historical data, and analysis to help communities understand where those hotspots are, where those most troubling intersections are. But then it's important to remind your listeners as well that this process is not going to be done in the clouds of night. There has to be public hearings. The local municipal body actually has to vote in favor to opt into the program. This is not a state mandate. Communities are not required to install these devices. They actually have to vote in favor of it, publicly notice where they will be, and hold public hearings to allow the community to voice their feedback, share their concerns, ask questions. So a very transparent process. And again, limited in scope. It's not going to be at every intersection and every corner and every neighborhood.
But it sounds like this is going to come down to the municipality hosting those hearings and coming up with a proposal of where those cameras should go. So it's really going to come down to the residents of that town or city to keep tabs on that, right? The state is not the one that is going to be putting into place these meetings in towns or city, because it's really up to the municipality to make that decision.
That's correct. We're developing guidance, a toolkit, if you will, which we'll share with all 169 municipalities by January 1st of 2024. And that will just provide some best practices, some guidance to help municipalities along the way. But yeah, you're absolutely right. If a town or city wants to opt into this program, the state is there to support, but the state is not there to dictate or to mandate these cameras. But I think any of your listeners can probably name four or five intersections or roadways in their communities where they think these could be a benefit. So the public feedback, the public input is really going to be critical to the success of the program.
And again, we have Josh Morgan here with the Department of Transportation here in Connecticut. Josh, how many cameras can a town or city have?
That's still being decided, but it's going to be limited because we don't believe that this is going to be effective on every street corner. It's really going to be those high crash areas where there has been a history of speeding, red light running, places near school zones or where there's a lot of pedestrian traffic. So again, it's not going to be used as a device to maybe score political points or to disproportionately impact certain communities. It really has to be driven by the historical data that we have with our partnership with UConn.
Who's paying for the cameras?
That will be the towns. So there's no state funding provided for this program. The towns and cities would bear the cost of installing these, of maintaining these, and any of the fines that are generated from the program also stay with the town or city. That money does not go to the state. Any of the fines generated through the red light cameras or the speed cameras stay in that community and would go to future traffic safety improvement projects, such as sidewalks, bike lanes, pedestrian crossings, things that would improve safety. So it's a program that any revenue generated stays directly in that community.
So essentially, it, you know, you're putting money up front, but it can fund itself, and hopefully it combats the problem and people drive safer. Now, if a town or city finds that they are seeing a huge improvement, let's say after a year they see a huge improvement, can they remove the cameras, stop funding them? Is that an option?
It is, and also there's a sunset. So once a camera goes up, it can't stay up for any longer than 3 years, and that's to allow the public and the community again to have another public hearing to make sure that a camera doesn't go up and it just stays there forever, because the point really is to improve safety, to change driver behavior. So you're absolutely right, Melissa. Like if after a year or two, they're really seeing that people have changed their behavior, have made a difference in improving safety in that area, that camera could come down. It could have another public hearing to be moved to another location. But these are not things that are going to be placed in perpetuity for the rest of our lives.
Josh Morgan is here, who's with the Department of Transportation. We're talking about the red light cameras and the importance of you showing up to those public hearings. So towns and cities are deciding whether or not they want the red light cameras, and they basically pay for themselves. They have like a 3-year contract. You can catch all of that, as Josh and I just talked about it a few minutes ago. It'll go up on our podcast, WICC600.com. Another thing, though, Josh, we want to give the heads up to folks that not just this weekend, but another weekend in November, if you're traveling I-95 between Westport and Norwalk, you might want to go a different direction because there's a big bridge project going on starting today. What's happening?
Yeah, absolutely, Melissa. Exit 17, the I-95 bridge over Saugatuck Avenue in Westport, we're going to be replacing the northbound side this weekend. We're going to be doing that in about 56 hours. So we're advising people to seek alternate routes, use public transportation. The highway is not going to be shut down. We're actually moving that northbound traffic, moving a couple lanes over to the southbound side. But that is certainly going to cause some backups, some traffic congestion. And people are probably asking, like, why are you doing this on a weekend? Because we're using a technique called accelerated bridge construction. And if people have traveled through 95 around this area, they've probably noticed on either side of the highway two structures being built. So we've actually built two bridges next to the highway. And what we're going to do this weekend, so starting tonight at 8 o'clock, we're going to move that traffic over to the southbound side, demolish the I-95 northbound bridge, and then slowly and carefully slide in a brand new bridge over the course of the weekend. So a weekend disruption instead of maybe a year or more of disruption if we were doing this as a typical construction project.
Have we done, it's called a lateral slide, right?
Correct, yep. Accelerated bridge construction and a lateral slide because literally we are going to be sliding this bridge into place. We did this in Stamford in around 2019, also on Interstate 95. We've done this in Waterbury about 10 years ago on Interstate 84. So it is a newer technique, a newer construction method, and it's just really an innovative way to deliver infrastructure improvements that, while it will cause some congestion this weekend, overall, in the grand scheme of the project, it's going to be much minimal, fewer traffic delays and disruptions than if we were doing this as a stage construction project, which would be about 12 months of lane closures and detours and things of that. So we're out there. I know I heard the forecast. It's going to be rainy today, this weekend. We are working rain or shine. So please use alternate routes. And if you are traveling in this area, just be patient. We have crews out there working throughout the weekend. So please travel slowly and carefully through the work zones.
So this weekend is going to be one side where they're doing this lateral slide. You said the northbound side, but then in the first weekend of November, correct, Josh, you're going to do the southbound side doing the same thing.
Absolutely. Yep. So we're going to give the communities a weekend off between these two projects. We are advising our neighboring states to put up messages on their variable message signs, those signs on the highway, avoiding the area for the truckers who are going to be coming through to seek alternate transportation. But similar to what we're doing this weekend, we're just going to flip it the weekend of November 3rd. So that southbound traffic will get detoured and moved over to the northbound side. We'll demolish that southbound bridge and then slide in that brand new bridge over the course of the weekend in 56 hours or less.
So please keep that in mind. And because people are going to go to alternate routes, which if you're just traveling through southwestern Connecticut, means you're probably going to go to the Mayor Parkway. You're probably going to go through town. Those are going to get congested as well. Nowhere near like what you're going to see on I-95 between Westport and Norwalk. But definitely pack your patience. You're going to need it this weekend and again in two weekends for that first weekend of November. But as Josh just mentioned, they're getting this knocked out in 3 days, which is really impressive. So instead of going through the headaches of construction going on for a year or so, they're knocking this out in a weekend. I think we can handle that. Josh, thank you so much for the update on that. And we certainly will put that message out there again in that first weekend of November as well. And at what time on Monday would you say, like, is that an all-day affair as well? Like, should people still find alternate routes on Monday when they start work up again next week?
Monday, no later than 6 a.m., that bridge is going to be open. Hopefully,
okay,
we'll have it opened sometime in those overnight hours into Monday morning. But the expectation is that this bridge is going to be completely finished. We're going to be out of there in time for the morning rush. But if people check I-95NorwalkWestport.com, that will have the latest updates. We actually have a camera posted on 95, so we're going to be updating photos every 10 minutes on the project website. But certainly check the DOT social media pages, check the website. If there are any unforeseen circumstances, we're certainly going to let the public know. But really the hope, the expectation, the goal, we're out of there no later than 6 a.m. Monday.
Perfect. Josh, thank you so much for the heads up on that and for talking about red light cameras, which are expected to be installed not by the DOT, but by the state starting in January. So another reminder, please, if your town or city is debating them, you should go to those public hearings. Josh Morgan, thank you so much. Have a safe weekend.
You as well, Melissa. Thanks so much.
Of course. Josh Morgan again, who is the Connecticut Department of Transportation spokesperson here on WICC.